Okay, so we'll be reading 2 Samuel chapter 24. Again, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he incited David against them, saying, "Go and take a census of Israel and Judah." So the king said to Joab and the army commanders with him, "Go throughout the tribes of Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, and enroll the fighting men so that I may know how many there are." But Joab replied to the king, "May the Lord your God multiply the troops 100 times over, and may the eyes of my lord the king see it." "But why does my lord the king want to do such a thing?" The king's word, however, overruled Joab and the army commanders, so they left the presence of the king to enroll the fighting men of Israel. After crossing the Jordan, they camped near Aroer, south of the town in the gorge, and then went through Gad and on to Jazer. They went to Gilead and the region of Tatim-Hodshi, and on to Dan, Jaan, and around towards Zidon. Then they went toward the fortress of Tyre and all the towns of the Hivites and Canaanites. Finally, they went on to Beersheba in the Negev of Judah. After they had gone through the entire land, they came back to Jerusalem at the end of 9 months and 20 days. Joab reported the number of the fighting men to the king. In Israel, there were 800,000 able-bodied men who could handle a sword, and in Judah, 500,000. David was conscience-stricken after he had counted the fighting men, and he said to the Lord, "I have sinned greatly in what I have done. Now, Lord, I beg you, take away the guilt of your servant. I have done a very foolish thing." Before David got up in the next morning, the word of the Lord had come to Gad, the prophet, David's seer. "Go and tell David, this is what the Lord says. I am giving you 3 options. Choose one of them for me to carry out against you." So Gad went to David and said to him, "Shall there come on you 3 years of famine in your land, or 3 months of fleeing from your enemies while they pursue you, or 3 days of plague in your land? Now then, think it over and decide how I should answer the one who sent me." David said to Gad, "I am in deep distress. Let us fall into the hands of the Lord, for his mercy is great, but do not let me fall into human hands." So the Lord sent a plague on Israel from that morning until the end of the time designated, and 70,000 of the people from Dan to Beersheba died. When the angel stretched out his hand to destroy Jerusalem, the Lord relented concerning the disaster and said to the angel who was afflicting the people, "Enough, withdraw your hand." The angel of the Lord was then at the threshing floor of Araunah, the Jebusite. When David saw the angel who was striking down the people, he said to the Lord, "I have sinned. I, the shepherd, have done wrong. These are but sheep. What have they done? Let your hand fall on me and my family." On that day, Gad went to David and said to him, "Go up and build an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Araunah, the Jebusite." So David went up as the Lord had commanded through Gad. When Araunah looked and saw the king and his officials coming toward him, he went out and bowed down before the king with his face to the ground. Araunah said, "Why has my lord the king come to his servant?" "To buy your threshing floor," David answered, "so I can build an altar to the Lord, that the plague on the people may be stopped." Araunah said to David, "Let the lord the king take whatever he wishes and offer it up. Here are oxen for the burnt offering, and here are threshing sledges and ox yokes for the wood. Your majesty, Araunah gives all this to the king." Araunah also said to him, "May the Lord your God accept you." But the king replied to Araunah, "No, I insist on paying you for it. I will not sacrifice to the Lord, my God, burnt offerings that cost me nothing." So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen and paid 50 shekels of silver for them. David built an altar to the Lord there and sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. Then the Lord answered his prayer in behalf of the land, and the plague on Israel was stopped.
Well, thanks for that, Kylie. A few names in there. You did really well. Well, good day, everyone. I'm Liam, the other pastor. So I get the treat of escorting those wonderful teens off to Central Asia. So please be praying for us all. And if you've got anything you'd like to send to the Turvies, we do have a bit of extra space in luggage, so feel free to drop it off this week. Just not too bulky and not overly, you know, no gold bullion, you know, take that yourself when you go to visit them or whatever, nothing too heavy. So that'd be fine. But please be praying as we go that Especially that it will be what it's meant to be, which is a support trip that we'll be able to, see how they're going and spend some really good quality time encouraging them. Yeah, well, as I reflect on my life particularly, and I think it's a general truth that sometimes you need to see something in action to learn a lesson. It's not good enough just to be told the detail or to read a truth. I've found this out the hard way. I can remember I was building a shed and Ellis said, hey, it's probably a good idea to build the shed to the slab to the exact size of the shed and overlap the sheets over the side. And I wanted to do something different, so I didn't do that. So it was lesson one, listen to Ellis. It may have been much more helpful for me if someone had said, hey, Liam, come over to my place. I want to show you the consequences of not overlapping your walls over the sides and seeing water leak in. So if you would like that kind of lesson, not just one you read, but a walkthrough lesson of someone else's mistakes, come over, spend some time with me. I'd be really happy to step you through it. But it is much more powerful, isn't it, to walk alongside someone and see the damage of the effects. It's one thing to read a truth, to read a standard, to say, hey, do this or don't do this, it won't end well. It's a whole other thing to kind of walk through with that person the process. Hey, this is what I did. Come and see how it ended up for me. Let's see the consequences. Let's see the damage. And that's what a lot of 2 Samuel's been doing for us. Have you felt that this term as we've been stepping through the life of King David? God could have, in about half a page, stood off all the mistakes David made and said, don't do them, it won't end well. He could have said, hey, don't do this, it won't end well. Don't do this, it won't end well. Do this, it will end well. He could have done that, but instead, he arranged for us for this whole narrative to record it, kind of stepping through the decision-making processes, stepping through with David, if you like, in his process, but also in the consequences that come. And it's all highlighting that together. And these last four chapters of 2 Samuel that we're looking at this week and next week, it feels a little bit jarring the first time you read it. Well, at least it did for me, because it's kind of the closing end of the book. Right in the middle, there's David's words. It's his last words. But around those last words, all these records of weakness and mistake and sin. And it can feel a little bit jarring. It can be like, well, has the author of this book forgotten what we've read here? What's going on? If they got some chapters mixed up, of an extra sheaf of paper slipped in. But it's not like that. They're here on purpose. And there's a really clever literary structure in Hebrew writing called a chiasm, where the main point is right at the center of a text. It's a little bit the opposite to the way we write. So if I'm writing a thesis or an essay or something, I'll put my main point at the start, the abstract, and then I'll give all the reasons for it, and then you finish with it. So we kind of do a reverse. We put the main point at the start and the finish, and the middle's the detail. In Hebrew, if you're trying to make a point, it's actually the opposite. You put the main point right in the middle, and you put kind of different bits of narrative around it to make your point, to emphasize the point. And that's what we see in these last four chapters. The Bible Project, which we had a look at in growth groups right at the start of this series, really helps us to see that. So these last four chapters, we see a central point, which is David's last words. So chapter 22 and the first bit of chapter 23, is kind of David's last words. And he's obviously elderly, he thinks he's going to die soon, and he's gathered whoever it is who's recording all this and said, hey, this is what I want people to remember. I want you to record my last words. And it's really significant, and next week's Rob's going to focus in on that. That's right in the middle. But what we're going to look together at today is the frame that goes around it. And there's actually two layers of framing that goes around this main point. And today we're going to look at the inner frame first. So there's the main, David's last words, the main point. And just outside of that are two different accounts that mirror each other's that show us David's weakness. Very different to the first part of Samuel where he was strong, virile, powerful. Where now seeing him as weak. And then as we move to the outer part of the frame, we actually see the sin of two kings. We touched on the sin of Saul last week, where he actually slaughtered the Gibeonites. He tried to commit a genocide. He tried to exterminate them. And God had already promised that that would not happen. So we touched on that at the start of 21. And we're going to look at the reading that Kylie did for us, chapter 23, where we see David's sin in the census and try and wrestle with, well, what did David do there that was so wrong? And wrap up with how the book wraps up, which is where David places his hope, even as he's experiencing the consequences that we just read through. So I'm going to pray for us as we jump in, and then we'll get straight into it. Please join me. Father God, we thank you and praise you that you record all this for our good, not just to waste paper, not just for some light reading, but everything that you've recorded in your word is that. It is your word for our good, for our learning, and we pray that we will understand, that we'll hear clearly, and that we'll take heed of these lessons as we look on these final chunks of David's life and the summary of that. I pray that you'd help me to speak clearly and to make the points that you want making for us today. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, first of all, David's weakness, and we've got two chunks, chapter 21, 15 to 22, and chapter 23, do that weakness. It's this outer frame, and they both actually focus on David's victories. And so if you're a king, you're recording your last words, your final impact for the coming generations, and you're recounting your victories, how you defeated your enemies, how would you do it? I think I'd go back to my highlights. I'd remember, oh, you remember that time where I defeated that giant, and he had this great big sword and a spear, and all I had was my little stones and my sling. Oh, you'd go back to your victories, the time when, King Saul asked for 100 Philistine foreskins, and I got him 200. Oh, maybe that wouldn't have made it into the final highlights, but these big, significant things that David's done. But actually, it is David's victories, but it's not as we expect. We expect his exploits, his power, but we instead get his weakness. We see that in verse 15, first of all. Once again, we read, there was a battle between the Philistines and Israel. This isn't consecutive, it's just looking back over all of David's history. Once again, there was this battle. David went down with his men to fight against the Philistines, and he became exhausted. He became weak. He ran out of energy. So this isn't what you expect, is it? In the final memoirs of a king. Hey, I want to tell you about a time I went into battle against the Philistines and I ran out of puff. I couldn't get the job done. I couldn't defeat them. And then after that, we have a count of four different incidents, four different opposers to Israelites, these Philistine mighty men. And they were all related to Goliath, that fellow who so famously fought against David with his sling. They're all from Gath, they're Goliath's family. And we actually see David defeat none of them. In the first little incident, Abishai actually saves David. So it looks like he went down, got tired. I'll take you on, I took on your uncle. And then he runs out of puff. He's about to die. He needs rescuing from Abishai. And in fact, the kind of mighty men, his warriors, gather around him and says, David, I think you're past your prime. We're going to leave you at home from now on. Do you pick that up there? You don't get to come out to fight with us anymore. You used to be our leader, the one who would kill the giants. You're now a liability. We can't risk you being in the field. You've got to stay at home. This doesn't sound like the exploits of a mighty king, does it? This is weak, David. He gets banned from fighting. And then as you go on, Shibbekai kills another one. We go on to the next one. Elahanan kills Goliath's brother. Another one, Jonathan, this time David's nephew, kills a six-fingered giant, had six fingers on each hand, six toes on each foot, this great big giant. And you see that, don't you? You see that it's just not working for David. What's going on? Why does he need these guys? There's these fearsome enemies. But they are all defeated in David's name. But none of them are defeated by David. David is weak, but still the victories are won. So what's the point here? Well, the point being made is that God is still keeping his promises despite David's weakness. See, back in 2 Samuel chapter 3, we've got this wonderful promise from God that he would defeat all the Philistines through David, that through King David, he would defeat all of Israel's enemies. And even though David is presented as kind of weak, a bit of a liability, we can't even take him into battle anymore, still God is keeping his promises, defeating his enemies. Now, if you flick to the other side of the frame, over to chapter 23, we get a big long list of all these warriors, these mighty men. David is, again, he's surrounded by powerful warriors, but he is personally weak. In chapter 23, verse 8 to 23, there's kind of a record of these individual exploits of just a few, these three mighty men who, it's kind of sounds like the three amigos. They went around killing people because they were so powerful. Nothing could stop them. And there's these exploits, and it's almost like a highlight of each of these people is highlighted. One guy was fighting for so long, his hand got frozen to his sword. I've been out using a hoe, chipping burrs for half a day and kind of gone to unwrap your hand from the end. And it's that kind of thing. He was fighting for so long, he couldn't even let go of his sword. Another guy defended a field of lentils. Took his stand against the Philistines, and not a lentil was harmed that day. Three other guys actually drew water. David made this offhand comment. Oh, he says, that well over there, it was about 15 kilometers away, that well over there, I wish I could drink from that well again. And these three mighty warriors took him literally, broke through enemy lines, went all through the town, drew some water from the well and brought it back to David just to say, here's that water you wanted, king. So there's these exploits of these mighty men. And then from verse 24 to 39, we have this list of 37 mighty men who David relied on. I'm not going to read them all, not going to list all their exploits, but I really wanted to highlight the last one because it hugely surprised me that David wanted this included in his memoirs. Have a look at the very last one, verse 39, the last of them. And Uriah the Hittite, there are 37 in all. Do we remember from Samuel who Uriah was? Uriah is Bathsheba's husband, a faithful warrior. We learn a mighty man, one of the key powerful men that David relied on to win God's victories. And it was his wife who he'd left behind. He'd gone off to fight for David, leaving his wife at home. And it was his wife who David looked down on from his palace and saw her bathing. It was Bathsheba, Uriah's wife, that David summoned and slept with her, impregnated her. And when he couldn't trick Uriah into sleeping, you see this wife to kind of try and cover it up, he had Uriah executed. He sent him back to the battle lines carrying a sealed message that Uriah was to be put in the front lines where the fighting is fiercest so that he would die. And here he is in the list of the mighty men, not even tucked in the middle, hoping we won't know it. Notice, he's right at the end. It's a point that's being made. David wants him here. David's included this list in his kind of memoirs. What's going on here with all these accounts of, David becoming exhausted and someone having to rescue him and him being locked away? Oh, we can't trust you to fight anymore. What's going on here with all these mighty men and they're fighting? Even Uriah, who was so faithful to David, and David betrayed him in every way possible. Well, this is included because I think it's showing that David is the weak link in this nation. God is saving his kingdom, delivering his people, despite David. Occasionally David got it right, but often David got it horribly wrong. And this is all included here on purpose. These men defended their king no matter what. And yet this king who betrays his own men. The greatest weakness in David's kingdom is David. Well, we see here a weak David with faithful friends and a promise-keeping God. And with that in mind, I want us to flick over to chapter 24 where we see David's sin. And thanks, Kylie, for reading this for us as we come into another narrative chunk. Again, it's not consecutive, so we've just had that big, long list of warriors ending with Uriah. And verse 1 of chapter 24, again, the anger of the Lord burns against Israel, and he incited David against them, saying, go, take a census of Israel and of Judah. So the king said to Joab and the army commanders with him, go throughout the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and enroll the fighting men so that I may know how many there are. But Joab replied to the king, may the Lord your God multiply the troops 100 times over, and may the eyes of my lord the king see it. But why does my lord the king want to do such a thing? Now it's a little bit confusing first reading to what's going on here. Why is taking a census such a bad thing to do? And it is bad. We see that as the chapter unfolds. There's punishment before that, especially when you read that God incites David against Israel to take the census. You could almost read from this chapter as though God gave David an instruction, go and take a census. But over in Chronicles, and we'll refer to this in a bit, there's another book after 1 and 2 Samuel called Chronicles that records much of the same detail, a bit like the Gospels, but with slightly different emphases. And in Chronicles, this same event is recorded, but we're told that Satan tempts David to do this. So it looks like, with the context around it, that God is allowing Satan to tempt David, a bit like he did with Job. God took responsibility by allowing Satan to tempt David. So what's the problem here with David taking a census, counting the people? What's inherently wrong there? Well, I think we get a little hint there in the end of verse 2. Why does David want to know? Well, he wants the count so that I may know how many fighting men they are. It feels like a bit of a vanity project. There's no useful reason. It's not like, oh, we've got a threat, we've got an enemy, I've got to work out if we've got enough men to defend us. It's not like they're preparing food stores just in case there's a drought. None of that. He just wants to know. It seems like he just wants to stroke his ego. What's going on here? And as we move through, I think that becomes clearer. We said especially, and we will flick over to 1 Chronicles 21, have a look at the way Joab sort of objects to David. He says to the king, oh, may the Lord multiply his troops 100 times over. So he says, oh, King David, I don't wish that there were no people. I hope that there's heaps. My lord the king, are they not all your subjects? Why does my lord want to do this? Why should he bring guilt on Israel? So over in Chronicles, Joab actually says, if you do this, it will be bad for our nation. You'll bring guilt. You shouldn't do this, David. There's something wrong here. There's a national understanding that this kind of counting, especially of military men, is wrong. Now, we don't have it recorded in the Old Testament, a particular law that forbids the king from counting. But back in Deuteronomy 17, we have this particular passage. We actually looked at this in growth group just briefly this week. In my growth group, as we're talking about King Solomon and the way it looks like he read this passage and said, I'm going to do everything on that list. Have a listen to this. The instructions to the king from God's law, Deuteronomy, the king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Israel, to Egypt to get them. For the Lord has told you, you may not go back that way again. He must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. So we have this description, very applicable to Solomon, because Solomon sort of goes, yeah, look, I don't think I'm going to do that. Actually, I'll do the opposite. But for David, it seems in this particular passage, David's trying to succumb to the allure of power. He wants to know how powerful he is. See, Solomon, he succumbs to that allure in a different way. He gets all the wives. He gets all the gold. It's a bit more obvious, the prosperity. But for David, it's military might. says, I want to collect it. I want to know. I want to know how many fighting men I have at my disposal. It seems that there's this lure to power and to wealth. The New Testament picks this up again and again and again. In the parable of the sower in Mark chapter 4, Jesus is speaking about the different ways that a faith can be derailed. I wanted to highlight particularly the weedy soil. So he's describing someone who has heard the good news of Jesus. They've responded and said, hey, I think I want to follow Jesus. But the allure of wealth has got to them. Have a listen to these words from Jesus. Still others, this is other people, like seeds sown among thorns, hear the word, but the worries of this life, the deceitfulness of wealth, and the desires for other things to come in and choke the word, making it unfruitful. It seems that's what's happened for David. He's having this faith, he's trusting God, but I want to know. I want to count my men. I love the power that comes with this military might. And it's getting to him. It's starting to choke him out. We have a instruction in 1 Timothy, and it's chapter 6, not chapter 5, sorry there, where Paul's actually warning us against this. He gives us in a positive way. He says, godliness with contentment is great gain. That's what Job was trying to say to David. Oh, David, they're all your people anyway. They're all your men. You don't need to count them. Paul says, godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world. We can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. Those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and have pierced themselves with many griefs. Kind of hear echoes of the warning to the king from Deuteronomy 17. Echoes of the way David and his son Solomon both got kind of dragged in with the allure of the blessings, the nice things in the world. Money, luxury, power. That's distracted them away from their faith. And for David in this chapter, there are real and instant consequences because of this sin. It seems as soon as the numbers start rolling back in after the generals get back, David is struck by his conscience. Have a look there in verse 10. David was conscience-stricken after he'd counted the fighting men. And he said to the Lord, I have sinned greatly in what I have done. Now, Lord, I beg you, take away the guilt of your servant. I have done a very foolish thing. Before David got up the next morning, the word of the Lord had come to Gad the prophet, David's seer. Go and tell David, this is what the Lord says. I'm giving you three options. Choose one of them for me to carry out against you. So Gad went to David and said to him, shall there come on you 3 years of famine in your land? Or 3 months of fleeing from your enemies while they pursue you? Or 3 days of plague in your land? Now then, think it over and decide how I should answer the one who sent me. This has been a bit of a theme in 2 Samuel as well, hasn't it? That sin has consequences. Now, again and again and again, forgiveness is offered when we're repentant. When David repents, God always forgives him. There's always forgiveness, but rarely are the consequences removed. And that's the way it works in our life. When we sin, we come to God. If we come to God genuinely repentant, remorseful, trying to turn away from that sin, trusting in Jesus' forgiveness, we are forgiven instantly. But there may still be real and ongoing consequences because of that sin that we have to just see out. That's the way this world works. It's the same way when we forgive others. Sometimes if I sin against somebody, they may well forgive me, but there might still be relational consequences. They might forgive me, but it might take them a while to trust me again. And the same way at the other end, forgiveness and consequences are two different things. And we see that again here, that there is consequences for this sin, national consequences. both with people and with God. But even in the midst of these consequences, we get a glimpse of David's hope. And we particularly see it there in the next verse, the way David responds. They're pretty hard options, aren't they? What do you want? 3 years of famine. How many will die? What will that do to your nation, to our people? Or 3 months of fleeing from your enemies. Well, what will that do to the nation? The nation kingless, without justice, and David running on the run again. Or 3 days of plague. How do you choose that? Well, as David chooses, we get a hint of his hope. Have a look there in verse 14. David said to Gad, "I'm in deep distress, but let us fall into the hands of the Lord, for his mercy is great. Do not let me fall into human hands." Do you see, even in the midst of consequences, David has a hope? And I think it's really important to stop here and see this, because in my life, I think sometimes when I talk to God, especially if things aren't going my way, I'm tempted to pray, "God, just give me what I deserve." Now, I'm not being very thoughtful at that point, because I think I deserve more than I do. I'm tempted sometimes to say, I work hard, give me what I deserve. But the reality that David sees here is that our greatest appeal to God is not justice, but mercy. And God is merciful. God is merciful. It's part of his character. And David has experienced that in his life with God again and again and again. That God is merciful. Yes, he takes sin seriously, but he forgives and he's merciful. And he was right. And if we read on, we see that. We'll read again these last verses. So the Lord sent a plague on Israel from that morning until the end of the time designated. And 70,000 of the people from Dan to Beersheba died. When the angel stretched out his hand to destroy Jerusalem, the Lord relented concerning the disaster and said to the angel who was afflicting the people, "Enough, withdraw your hand." The angel of the Lord was then at the threshing floor of Araunah, the Jebusite. Now, what happens here, this is the kind of behind the scenes thing that David can't see, that God sent out his angel, the plague is falling on the people, tens of thousands of people are dying. And at the same time that this is happening, David's having a personal crisis because he's seeing his people die. And he knows that it's not their fault, it's his fault. I wonder if you've felt that when you've seen the effect of your sin on others. And in a way, you think, "Oh, this isn't right, this isn't fair. Why are these people I love suffering because of my sin?" That's how David is feeling. And from verse 17, we kind of get the parallel time. So behind the scenes, God's angel is bringing this plague. And here's what David is feeling and seeing from verse 17. When David saw the angel who was striking down the people, he said to the Lord, "I've sinned. I, the shepherd, have done wrong. These are the sheep. What have they done? Let your hand fall on me and my family." On that day, Gad went to David and said to him, "Go up, build an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Araunah, the Jebusite." So David went up as the Lord had commanded through Gad. When Araunah looked and saw the king and his officials coming towards him, he went out, he bowed down before the king with his face on the ground. Araunah said, "Why has the Lord, my king, come to your servant?" "To buy this threshing floor," David answered, "so I can build an altar to the Lord, that the plague on the people may be stopped." Araunah said to David, "Let my lord the king take whatever he wishes and offer it up. Here are my oxen for the burnt offering, and here are the threshing sleds and ox yokes for the wood. Your majesty, Araunah gives all this to the king." Araunah also said to him, "May the Lord your God accept you." But the king replied to Araunah, "No, I insist on paying you for it. I will not sacrifice to the Lord my God burnt offerings that cost me nothing." So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen and paid 50 shekels of silver for them. David built an altar to the Lord there and sacrificed the burnt offerings and threshing and fellowship offerings. Then the Lord answered his prayer on behalf of the land, and the plague on Israel was stopped. So there's that parallel in verse 25 with verse 17. That's what's going on in David's life as God relents. Do you see how David was right to put his trust in God's character? Because God had promised that this plague should keep going. And David said, "Oh, Lord, don't let me fall into the hands of men. They won't show mercy. But maybe if I fall into the hands of God, he will show mercy." And he did. And he did. And in this, I think there's some really key points for us. I think the first one is to put our hope in God's merciful character. And I want to encourage us to do that both for here and now and for eternity. I can slip very easily into thinking that I actually have a case before God of why maybe I might just slip into heaven, why I might be okay, why I might escape judgment. Especially as I go on in my Christian faith and maybe I have kicked a couple of sins that I want to kick. I go, wow, that's gone, that's kicked. Well done, Lamb. But that's not a position to put our confidence in. We don't go to God and say, "Hey, God, look at these sins I've got rid of. Look what I've done. Look how I've responded." We're still sinful. We still deserve God's judgment. We are so far from perfect. And David knew that. For all his faults, David knew that. And put his hopes in God's mercy, not in God's justice. See, the big difference between David, King David, and King Saul were not that King David got more things right than Saul. In fact, when I look at King Saul's list of failures and look at King David's list of failures, David seems way worse than Saul. But what's the big difference? David appeals to God's mercy. Saul makes excuses. When Saul's confronted with his sin, he gets defensive. He says, "Yeah, but I did this other stuff. Oh, it wasn't quite like that." When David's confronted with his sin, he's broken. He says, I have no appeal. I did wrong. May I throw myself at your mercy." So that's this first thing, to put our hope in God's merciful character. The second, I think, thing that we can take from this is that we need to listen to God's escape instructions. Because that's what David did, didn't he? David had the confidence that God would be merciful. He cried out to God and said, "God, stop this plague." And God gave him some instructions about what to do and where to go and how to worship. So he did those things and the plague stopped. So when God gives us escape instructions, we should listen to them. In the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, we have this warning that rings in my ears. How shall we escape if we ignore such a great salvation? It's talking about the gospel, the good news of Jesus. Trusting in Jesus for forgiveness is God's escape instructions. Don't think that there's some other way around to get around God's justice, his judgment. There's not. When we've got ourselves in a mess, which we have, when we have sinned, when we have rebelled against God, and he reaches out with escape instructions, we need to listen up. And those escape instructions, particularly in this passage, encourage us to run to the eye of the storm for safety. Now, it doesn't use those words, but that's the picture that I have. Because it is strange in a way, isn't it? Who is sending this plague on Israel that has killed 70,000 people so far? Who? It's God. God sent the plague. It's God's hand of wrath that is stretched out on his people. And where is David told to run? He says, "Well, run to God. Come to God. The one who is inflicting judgment is the one you need to escape to. Don't run from the storm of wrath. Run to the source of the wrath." I think we get a really helpful picture of this in Psalm 2. This psalm in this book of prayers from the Old Testament. It's describing the nations of the world raging against God, raging against God's king. And the psalmist has introduced God's saving king. And here's his exhortation to all the people of the world, to us. He says, "Therefore, you kings, be wise, be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear. Celebrate his rule with trembling. Kiss the Son, or he will be angry, and your way will lead to your destruction, for his wrath can flare up in a moment." Really striking description of Jesus, isn't it? Wrathful, destructive, bringing judgment. And then the very last line, "Blessed are all who take refuge in him." The wrath of God, the wrath of the Son is coming on all who have rebelled against God, who have failed to give him the honor that is his due. And where are we called to run for refuge? To the source of that wrath, to where it's coming from, where judgment is coming from. Because of God's character. Because he's a God of mercy. And we're actually going to celebrate that now by sharing the Lord's Supper together.